Good morning, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another edition of the Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today has just published her first book, Tomorrow Comes, and I have to say I am greatly impressed. It is a very unique book. It is my great pleasure to welcome Donna Mabin to the program. Donna, hello.
Hello, Simon. How are you?
I'm doing great. And I understand you're in lovely Chicago, enjoying some fine weather.
Yes, our cycle seems to have been that it's either too cold to go outside, or if it warms up a little bit so that you can stand it, it's snowing. So I'm not sure when we'll be out of this cycle, but I believe it will come someday. So tomorrow will come.
Before we talk about Tomorrow Comes, I'd like to find out a little about who Donna is. Would you care to share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am, as you said, I live in Chicago with my husband, Rod, and one of my daughters, Sarah, who's moved back and now resides in our basement. I understand that's what people do these days. kids do that cycle in and out, but we're delighted to have her. And I work for Northern Trust, which is a financial institution. I've always been in the people business, primarily as an educator. So I have had to write many white papers and presentations, and I published a lot of sort of nonfiction information, but this is my first foray into the fictional world. Well, sort of half fiction, half reality.
Yes, indeed. You know, I have a nasty habit of wanting to pigeonhole books, you know. And this one, you know, kind of has me stumped.
Well, my husband likes to think that we've created a new genre called, I think he calls it reality fiction, but I don't know, maybe that's something that others have done, but it does feel very different. I think that's one of the things that people react to, is that they just don't, they don't know quite how to think about it.
Right. I've read several books in this genre, albeit completely different subject. Mm-hmm. And my pet term is faction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. Have you copyrighted that, or can we start to use that?
you are welcome to use it.
That's perfect.
Tomorrow Comes is obviously a very, very personal quest. Would you care to talk a little bit about the book, give us a synopsis of it?
Sure. Well, as you said, it's sadly based in fact, and that fact is that in the summer of 2011, we extremely unexpectedly lost our 19-year-old daughter. She had celebrated with the friends and family that night, had pizza, Skyped with me. I happened to be in London at the time, and just had a wonderful evening and went to bed, and the next day she didn't wake up. So she had no known medical issues. She certainly wasn't on drugs. There was nothing that the toxicology report showed. She just simply died, and I hitherto could not have imagined losing a child, and certainly couldn't have imagined losing a child in that way. I think when you've got teenagers, you're always a little worried about something. You know, will they drive safely? Will they be responsible at parties and all of that? But you certainly never worry when they go to bed in their own bed at, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and then the next day, you know, are gone. So the book is really, you very well articulated that it is a personal quest. I initially started to write it because I just couldn't imagine that Emma was here one day and gone the next. And so I felt the need to create some kind of scenario in which she was somewhere. And it's very personal because I would say I didn't have a strong faith to fall back on. So I didn't fundamentally believe, hadn't really thought too much about whether there's a heaven or, you know, just what happens after you die. I don't have a very strong faith that tells me all of those answers. And so the book was really a way to... the book was many things, but one of them was a way to try to figure out in some ways what could possibly have happened and what could possibly be going on now. So the book goes back and forth between the very first line in the book is Emma opens her eyes. And so it quickly becomes clear. There's a little bit of a mystery, as you know, since you read it in the beginning, of just exactly what's going on, because that chapter ends with her seeing a dog that had died 3 years earlier, but she has no idea what's happening to her. But the book goes back and forth between her discovering what has happened and connecting with people that she knew in what I call before, which is our reality here, and how she still can see what's going on with the family. She still can kind of observe and finds ways to stay connected with the family. But it goes back and forth chapter by chapter between Emma discovering what's going on and us trying to figure out how to live a life without her. She was a huge presence in the lives of everybody that she knew, and it's quite a journey that we're still on, frankly, to figure out how to recreate around that huge hole in our lives. So this really is the first 3 or 4 months after she died and kind of what's going on with everybody. Or what may be going on. What's definitely going on, the reality part is what's definitely was going on with us. So a question that people ask after they read it is, did those things really happen? And the answer is yes. I have no idea what's going on with Emma, but I certainly hope that's what's happening with her.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Where was Emma when this happened? I believe she was going to university, or
yeah, she was going to the Illinois State University. She was home for the summer. She had just finished her freshman year of college. She and her dad had just signed a lease for her first apartment, and she was busy buying new things to put in it. She had just been accepted into the art program at Illinois State, which was a source of great pride to her and to all of us. And so you would say that she was sort of on the cusp of her dreams, and to think that she sort of died in her dreams makes it, if possible, doubly hard. I was in London on an assignment for Northern Trust, and my other daughter, Sarah, happened to be there with me. So we got the dreaded call when we were in Amsterdam. It's a call certainly no one can ever imagine getting. My husband called to say the worst possible thing has happened. Emma has died. And you can imagine the shock and the fact that we were, I don't know, however many miles Amsterdam is from Chicago away, certainly made it more painful to try to get back and face the reality of what had happened.
Right. You know, you say in the book, and you just told me on the phone, that she had no medical issues, that, you know, she just went to sleep and never woke up. Has anyone ever given you an inkling as to, you know, what the cause was?
So apparently there's something, and I've done some research into this, but I'll tell you, a friend of mine sort of who had lost her husband in a dreadful accident that had she been home, she probably could have prevented. But she said at some point it doesn't really matter how a loved one dies. It matters that they're gone. But people have told me that there is a syndrome that's very similar to sudden infant death syndrome. It was called sudden adult death syndrome. And basically, again, I tried to research myself to death on the internet and never really found anything absolutely conclusive, similarly to how they never really find anything conclusive with SIDS. But basically, it's often, not often, thank goodness, but it affects young women. And basically, it's something that was unknown, likely going on with the heart, but you can't even uncover it in an autopsy, which is really why it's called just sudden adult death. You know, and now I'm speculating here, but I mean, she had to die from something. So my assumption is that there was something medical going on that just was undetectable.
Wow. And I have to admit that I thought your approach to the grieving process was truly, truly unique. Mm-hmm. When did you make the decision to write the book?
So I've always been interested in writing. In fact, my husband and I have long talked about that we should, you know, write a book together. And people know that about me. And so several people suggested when Emma died, I mean, that perhaps instead of just, you know, crying and sort of staying in bed and considering it to be a good day if I got up and, you know, brushed my teeth, that perhaps I should start to write down some of my thoughts. And I tried to do that, and they were very dark. I mean, they just really weren't, I wouldn't say that they were sort of helping. So a number of things actually came together. I had watched a program, it was actually House, so you being from London, I'm sure have great pride in that show. There was an episode where House was working with an author, a woman who had lost her son, and she no longer wanted to live. And House was very interested in saving her, both because he's House, but also because she was the author of his favorite books, and her son was the hero of those books. And it sort of got me thinking, I wonder what Emma would have been like. I wonder if Emma had lived, what kind of heroine she would have become. You know, what was she going to do? What was her life going to be about? And I was trying to think what special skills she had, what would make her a hero, what would cause people to think of her in that way. And it occurred to me that it was just simply because she was who she was. She was a very kind young lady. She was very funny. She was naive in that she believed what people told her, and she thought the best in them. And that was one of the reasons that everybody considered her to be their best friend. She was always the one that they could go to that would make them feel better, that would listen to them, that would believe in them. And I thought, you know, they're kind of heroic qualities. Could I write about Emma as a hero, as someone who could just be loved because of who she was? And so that sort of got me thinking that I could write, but it would be a different kind of writing than I think people had recommended, which was really just writing down my thoughts. So that was one thing that kind of factored into it. The other thing that factored into it was that we were all struggling with how to talk about Emma. She was so much a part of our lives. She was one of those rare 19-year-olds who still, despite being very popular, would rather be with her family than anybody else. And so we just didn't know how to talk about her. We didn't want to say Emma was. We couldn't imagine her in the past. We knew that we could no longer say Emma is. And so we started to talk about her as a sort of a what would she? What would she be doing? What would she be saying? How would she handle this kind of thing? So it really started to help the family to be able to keep talking about Emma. We gathered every Sunday, and I'd read what I had written, and my son would say, oh, no, that's not what she would have done. You know, she would have been really irritated about that, or, you know, he actually used a little stronger language. So at any rate, it really brought us together as a family to really be able to think about Emma in a way that acknowledged that she was no longer here, but that hoped that she was somewhere.
I was very impressed by the way that, you know, the family came together. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're a close-knit unit. Mm-hmm. But I was also impressed by you know, the comments from her friends.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, she was a very popular young lady.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was quite popular. In fact, it's funny. again, not funny, sort of hard to use that word as it relates to something as tragic as this, but her friends were just at an age where they were starting to begin the journey of kind of finding their own way. So, you know, that first year after high school, everybody's together in college and they think they're going to be friends forever. And then the second year, they start to pick their majors and start to kind of, you know, maybe stay where they're going to school over the summer and all that kind of thing. And so one of the things that's really so it compounds the fact that they lost Emma. They now all think of her as the glue that sort of held them all together. And now that they're all sort of starting to go their separate ways, they're graduating from college this year, you know, they believe that Emma's death was the reason that they sort of are no longer as close as they had been. Now, you and I both know that that's something that happens, you know.
Right.
Your high school, you manage to keep a couple of your high school friends if you're lucky, and then your paths just go in different directions. But this large circle of friends really, I think, equates some of that growing up with the loss of Emma, which makes it all the more poignant.
Right. Did you have much interaction with her friends when you were writing the book?
Some. I thought you were going to ask when she was alive, and the answer there was I was trying to keep them from drinking beer in the basement and chasing them away. I believe lot closer.
I believe the favorite brand was Ice House, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. Cheap, I understand. I've gotten much more close to them as a result of writing the book, and you know, and as time goes on, I've stayed very connected with several of them. We have an annual fundraising event for a scholarship in her name that, you know, they all come to no matter where they are, no matter what they're doing. And then we have a birthday party when they're home for Christmas vacation. So I don't know how long that will go on, but that brings us all great comfort that we have stayed very connected. They're probably more involved with the second book because the first was so much about the family. I mean, yes, I could pull off Facebook what her friends were thinking and saying and all that, but I'll tell you, I was not in any shape when I wrote the first book to comfort anybody but myself, you know, so I really wasn't terribly connected with her friends then. But I would say in the second book, they're much more influential in terms of how that's playing out.
I'm going to come back to the second book a little later on. Obviously, the prime subject of Tomorrow Comes is Emma.
Right.
But you also talk quite a bit about her Aunt Pat.
Mm-hmm.
Were the two close?
So I think they were as close as you can be when you're 55 years apart. I mean, you know, Aunt Pat was my Aunt Pat. It was actually her great, but everybody called her Aunt Pat or Aunt Patsy. We didn't live near them for much of Emma's life, but we would always go home to see my parents and my aunt and my cousins for very special occasions like Thanksgiving and that sort of thing. And I think that they really shared just some very similar passions. Aunt Pat was very fashionable, very with it. She was, you know, she dyed her hair until the day she died, you know, bright red. She had beautiful jewelry, and she was kind of eccentric, and she and Emma loved to shop. So I would say that they were close. I think the reason that Aunt Pat was the one who met her when she first got there is because Aunt Pat was the person who had died in our family just shortly before Emma did, and we were all quite shocked by that. My mother had been very ill, and my aunt was quite active, and my mother was in the hospital for all kinds of things and came out of it, and my aunt went in for minor surgery and died. So, you know, we were all still sort of reeling from that when Emma died. So I think the fact that, you know, and I think at some point in the book I say that Aunt Pat sort of feels as though that's why she died, so that she could in part be there you know, for Emma. So it was really more the proximity of their deaths and the similarities between them that that caused Aunt Pat to be a major character. But they were certainly close. But again, you know, 19-year-olds don't have a lot of time for 75-year-olds.
I rather liked your view of After, which you portray very much as a mirror image of Before.
Mm-hmm.
Is this your belief?
So I would say my belief is, my husband's going to be mad because I realize I've started a couple of sentences with so let me take that back. I would say that that after, again, I think as I said earlier, I don't know. I'm in the process of trying to determine what it is I believe. So I understand this world. You know, I understand what made Emma happy in this world. I understand what she was like in this world. And so I think it was very natural for me to picture her. And you know, she was someone who loved life. I mean, one of the things that's so annoying that people say, and I know that they're well-intentioned, but, you know, well, she's in a better place. No, she's not. I mean, this was a great place for her. She loved it here. She loved her life. And so it was in part a reaction to say people saying, well, it's a better place. No, it's not. The best place for her would be exactly like here, you know, with maybe a couple of cool things, like the hot tub's a little bigger so she can fit more friends in it. And, you know, her hair is back to being blonde, which she was kind of a little irritated that she had chosen to dye it red for our trip to Ireland. So, you know, there are certainly some differences. She learns that she can get places without her, you know, without her car. I mean, you know, there are certainly some things that over time evolve to be almost better than they are here. But initially, for the transition, if you will, as she was trying to figure out what in the world had happened, and I was so, a mother feels so worried for their child. What? Who's going to protect them? How are they going to make their way? What, you know? And so the more like here I could make it, better off I felt she was, and the more that I could understand her, what she was doing and where she was. Now, and I know you said you'd get to the second book, but in the second book, differences start to increase between where she is and where she was. But in the first book, I wanted it to be, for her sake, much like what she experienced here, because it was heaven for her to live. So,
and I think it's probably time to move on to some absolutely shameless commercialization. where can people buy Tomorrow Comes? Amazon or?
Oh, yeah, all the traditional places. So Amazon, you know, it's on Goodreads. We have a website that we hope to really grow to be publishing other. My husband's always been interested in the publishing world, and so we have a website that's called Starshine Galaxy, one word, starshinegalaxy.com, and people can find out a lot more about Emma. There's a slideshow of her growing up and her laughing and, you know, all kinds of things, and as well as, you know, about the scholarship and about the things that we do, as well as other activities that Starshine Galaxy is involved with. So it's quite a nice place to go and visit with the family and visit with Emma. But the book can be bought just about anywhere. I do want to mention that there's a local bookstore, which is where she worked, Townhouse Books and Cafe. So if anybody hears this who's in the Chicago area, it's a lovely, lovely independent bookstore, and they were the first ones to want to sell it. So it's right there front and center when you come in. And again, it's where she works. So if you read the book, it would be nice to pay a little visit there, or if you want to go there to buy the book, it's where she worked. And my son still works there, and he loves it when people come in and say, "Are you Ben Mebbin? Are you from the book?" That's his favorite thing. I know as you've read the book, you know that's a joke, because he's an introvert, and so he hates this more than anything, that the book is starting to gain some popularity. But you know, he loves that people are starting to come and know Emma. They just wish they didn't have to come and know him.
Obviously, it's still very early days, but what sort of feedback are you getting from readers?
It's interesting that the feedback from readers, early readers, is really what caused us to make it available more broadly. I, all along, was thinking that I was writing a book for friends and family, that I wanted people to know all about Emma and never forget. And again, as I said, it was a big part of the healing process, which is still going on for us. But early readers, people would then give the book to a friend, or one woman asked if she could use it with her book club, and I said, well, I guess so. I mean, that seems a little weird. But at any rate, people started finding me, people who had gotten it from a friend of a friend and that kind of thing. And a couple of things really prompted us to really start to push a little bit to get it out there. One is, universally, and I think you even said it, Simon, the first thing people say is, I loved Emma. I loved her. You know, she was a free spirit and funny and, you know, naive and all of those things. And I just really rooted for her. I loved her. So that is very rewarding to a parent to have that kind of legacy continue. You know, I had Emma lived, I think she could have done big things. And so perhaps this is the way that she will live. So that was one thing. But the second thing was that it gave, almost everybody said it gave them hope. I talked with a woman who was a staunch Catholic and said, you know, I thought I knew what I believed and I thought I was okay with death. And then my sister died and it wasn't enough what I knew. I needed to know more. I needed to know, where is she? What's she doing? What's the shape of things? And she said, and I read your book and I could suddenly imagine that's where she is. And it gave me great comfort even 10 years after she died. So I've, of course, heard from a number of people who have lost children, but I've also heard from people who haven't lost anybody who have said that it really has started to help frame for them some comfort with sort of, it sounds trite, but kind of the life goes on kind of thing. And the second thing is that it really reinforces that to live life with no regrets, because you just never know. Who imagines going to bed and just never waking up when you're a kid, you know, or even when you're 60, 61, which is my age. You just don't imagine it. My daughter Sarah has really embraced that aspect of it, and she's traveling all over the place, saving penguins in South Africa and saving turtles in Costa Rica, and, you know, and she said, it's because I don't want to have any regrets, and that's because of Emma. So I what has amazed me is almost everybody who's read it, man, woman, young, old, someone who's in a loss, who's lost somebody, someone who's not, finds themselves in the book somewhere. I think the other thing about that is that there's so many different perspectives. I'm an extrovert, obviously, and my, you know, my feelings are in there, although not as much as some of the others. But Ben is an introvert, so, and my son Jason is has been the black sheep for a number of years of the family, and so everybody can find something in it that they can relate to, and I think that's why, in fact, we decided to go public, if you will, with a very personal story.
Okay, I'm going to ask about the dreaded M word. what are you doing in the way of marketing? Are you doing any book signings or things like that?
Yes, we're in the early stages of really trying to figure out what that looks like and what that means. Certainly I have done a few book signings. Everybody who buys the book, I mean, I don't know if that counts, but wants some sort of, you know, signature in it, and the ones that come from Starshine Galaxy are very personalized. But I think where I've probably gotten the most traction to date is book clubs. So I have done some book clubs virtually where they've asked me to Skype or for a few minutes if they're around here. I've done some where I've actually joined you know, for part of it. So I think book clubs are kind of the way to go in large part in terms of marketing, because it is such a personal book. It is such a personal story, and it really encourages people to talk about their own lives, their own situations, their own beliefs. So that has been pretty successful for us. We've done, you know, we did kind of an interesting mailing of bookmarks that are adorable. I don't know if you got one or not, but
yes,
I was going to ask
you about that. I read a lot of books, and I can honestly say, Tomorrow Comes was the first book that came with a stick-on tattoo.
Well, you know, when I meet with people personally, other than asking, almost always the first thing that people ask is, did you guys really get tattoos? Because if you know us at all, you would know that we were not the kind of family that got tattoos, but we did. Really the day after Emma's funeral, in part because she had one, and she was always trying to get the rest of us to get one. And so, yes, we all did get tattoos, and there's a tattoo for readers to, and again, that's if it comes from Starshine Galaxy. Amazon, unfortunately, will not allow us to put tattoos in all the books that come from them, but the ones that are ordered from Starshine Galaxy have a tattoo right on the page where the family went and all got tattoos, which I'm told is one of the funniest chapters in the book. I don't know, Simon, if you had that experience, but I think people go to this book thinking, oh, God, this is going to be a chore because it's going to be so sad, you know, and I think what surprises people is that there are moments of a lot of humor, and again, at the end, I think just the hopefulness, probably more hopefulness than I felt or feel, but certainly, so it's been a surprise to me that that's what people are left with, but I think the surprise to early readers is just the humorousness, of, you know, that there are parts that are genuinely laugh out loud funny.
There are. And you're quite correct. The tattoo excursion was was just delightful.
Thank you.
You and your husband Rod opted to create your own publishing company, and I'm curious because I'm a book kind of a guy. Why did you take that road, rather than one of, you know, just using one of the myriad of print-on-demand companies out there?
Well, two reasons. One, the first is that it's always something that my husband has been interested in. He does it. He oftentimes will quote, publish something to help somebody else. He had a friend recently who died, and he pulled together all of her letters and published it. He's working with his great-grandfather was a preacher in Wales, and so he's pulled his sermons, or perhaps it was his great-great-grandfather, I forget, all his sermons together, and has, you know, he's very, very good at making the written word pulled together in a way that just really speaks to people. And again, it's been primarily as a something for friends and family. It's just kind of a hobby, but something he's always been interested in. So this really made sense for him because he's experienced and he does this, and he's been thinking that he'd like to get into this business anyhow. So that's one reason. The second reason is, as you started the interview with saying, this is a very personal book. And I think the horror stories you hear about all the rejections and all of the things that you have to go through, you know, with those folks out there. And I know you're talking about Vanity Press, too, where it's print on demand and all of that. But even in that case, it felt too personal to sort of turn over, if you will, to somebody else. So it was just a partnership that made sense for us, both because of his interests in that world, and because of my interest in not being as vulnerable as all that, as to try to go some other route.
Yeah, I know another author that took that particular route. He spent 2 years getting rejection letters.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but He's the kind of guy that doesn't give up easily. In fact, he decorated his office with the rejection letters.
They motivate him, do they?
Yeah.
And, well, I would.
And finally just set up his own company.
Yeah. And I would say that for me, it was and remains a fairly fragile, time. I'm a fighter too, but this is just, so personal. And I think, again, the sort of working through of our own journey is probably the main thing in this. The other thing is that I don't dislike money, but we're not in this to make money. I mean, I think what we would like to do is break even. I mean, if my husband had his way, he'd use all of our savings and publish a million books and just go hand them out to people on the street because he wants everybody to know Emma, to know and love Emma. I'd like to break even, so I'm a little bit more practical about that. I'd just as soon not take our retirement money and give everybody a book about Emma, but it's not about the money. It's really about the two things I talked about before. Emma no longer is able to have people love her who didn't know her except through the book. And the second thing is, I'm 61. I've been in professional business all my life. At 61, maybe a little before, or maybe a little after, but around then people start saying, really? What's this all about? What did I do? what was this work that I've done? What did it really matter? And I think there's a sense that I have, a fledgling sense, a hope, that this book matters, that it will matter to some people, that it will help some people go through the devastation in a little less horrific of a way. I'm hoping it matters. So,
right. I was chatting with your husband, Rod, and Starshine Galaxy, has a second book. I do have to ask you about it. I thought it was delightful. Even the title, A Book, A Bot Chats.
Well, that's so that was Emma's first foray into art, I guess, and it was when she was in first grade, and she delightfully, absolutely got it all wrong. It's a book about shapes, actually, not a boot chaps. it's something that that she had as an assignment, and I actually found it. We keep everything. You know how parents are; you keep absolutely everything that your kid ever done. But I found it at one point and showed it to her, and I said, "Oh, see, you were always artistic. You were always smart." But of course, she spelled everything wrong. It's a diamond, not a diamond; a kirkle, not a circle. And she's gotten some of the shapes wrong, which is just so delightful. And it kind of epitomizes Emma. That kind of stuff didn't really matter to her. When she was young, I gave her a puzzle, and she couldn't figure out the puzzle, so she started to make all the puzzle pieces into little children, and she'd wrap them up in tissues and put them to bed and all that stuff. So she wasn't one that really kind of, the details of something didn't really matter too much to her. It was just the experience of it. So it's really the first art that Emma did, and it is a delightful little book because it's so wrong but so right at the same time. And I will tell you, back to this same Townhouse Cafe, which is a celebratory place here in St. Charles. There's always a line and all that, but they've created a garden called the Chaps Garden, and they've put outside of their restaurant, and they've made all the shapes in bricks wrong, and then they planted Lady Emma Hamilton roses in the middle of these brick shapes. So it's lovely that in addition to having this book in print, that there's a living thing that also contributes to it. One of the reasons that Rod chose to publish that was because we had the actual book that she had written among the thousands of items that we had at her funeral, and everybody was so enamored with this book that Rod published it to everybody who came to the funeral. So,
and we're just about out of time, but in my review, I made a comment that you know, I thought you were a talented writer and hoped you would continue. Now, you've mentioned a couple of times that mm-hmm. you are working on a second book. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a flavor?
Sure. I think I mentioned earlier that it's called Tomorrow Matters, an Emma story, and in it, it takes us through the first year after her death and the changes that have happened to her and the things that she's experiencing. And as I think I mentioned earlier, her world starts to shape and shift a little bit differently than before. And then we moved on is not the right word, but we decided to do the scholarship. I decided to write the book. There's an interesting interaction between Emma and I with regards to writing the book. There are some things that she is excited that I got exactly right, and there are some things that she thought were absolutely ridiculous. You know, she said, "Mom, I mean, because she's not saying this to me directly, but her view is, you know, well, that's my crazy mom making stuff up." There is a part of the first book, and it's not a big part, but where Emma did experience a very difficult thing in her life, and I don't want to really share what that is. People can sort of read the book and find out. But she works through that. It was something that she didn't have an opportunity to work through when she was alive, and so she works through that. She has to pay for some of the rules that she broke in the first book, but in a way that turns out to be very positive. So it's really a story of, I think the very first thing that happens when you've experienced a loss is you just can't believe that you're going on, that tomorrow, you know, that tomorrow does come. Again, the title of the first book is sort of for both of us. It comes for her, and it comes for the family, and it comes for her friends. You can't stop that. It comes. I spent many months wishing I could stop tomorrow from coming, you know, because it's just every parent's worst nightmare, and it happened to us, and you know, we couldn't believe it. But at any rate, at some point, tomorrow starts to matter again. You know, it does start to matter again. And that's the kind of thing that I'm working through now for me, for my family. For example, there's a relationship that's just starting between Ben, my son, and a woman who was very dear to him after Emma died and knew Emma and all of that. They're now engaged. So, you know, tomorrow does matter. It goes on, it comes, and it matters. And so this is the second part of the journey. People ask me, are you going to, you know, do you envision this as a trilogy? And I said, it's my life. I don't know what I envision it as. Right now we're going through trying to have tomorrow matter. I don't know what happens next. Maybe I'll write a third book. Maybe I'll write 10 books. I don't know.
Do you have a planned publication date?
Yes, actually, it's come and gone. My plan was to have it completed on the anniversary of her death this year, which was July 8th. I'm sorry, in 2013. So now my conviction is to have it published by, or have it completed by July 8th of this year.
Donna, we are completely out of time. But I do want to thank you for taking time to talk to us today. And I'm sure I speak for everyone at Blogger News in wishing you great success. And hopefully we can talk again.
That would be great.
When your new book is out.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you very much, Simon. I actually enjoyed it more than I thought I would. So thank you for that.
Okay.
I always wonder what it will be like to talk about Emma. You know, you never know. And you didn't get tears, so that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you have a happy, healthy, and hopefully warm
uh-huh.
week in Chicago.
Yeah, well, we won't have it warm, but hopefully healthy and happy. So thank you so much.
Okay, I'll talk to you again.
Until
next time, this is Simon Barrett saying goodbye. We'll be back again soon. Till then, goodbye.
Thank you.